Okay, thank you for this introduction. And during past weeks we heard many very nice talks about supernovae 1A, about fine details of light curves, about details of burning and so on. But after some discussion with Razan and with Lars, who is not here, we decided to put progenitors of supernovae 1A to consider progenitors of supernovae 1A in the more general great picture of the evolution of binaries. And so my talk may have an alternative name. So why not all binary stars produce S-novae, supernovae 1A progenitors? Of course, I was quoted several times, but I still think that this old wisdom is correct. So, and now I can start. So, to my understanding, the aims of the binary star evolution theory is to understand the origin of very different binary stars from primordial binaries, which differ only in three parameters. This is masses of components and their initial separations. Next, we have to explain the observational manifestations of all these different binaries. Next, we have to estimate or evaluate the numerical parameters of the population of binary star in the galaxy or in the galaxies and its evolution. And last but not least, we have to understand the selection effects which form the observed set of binaries. In my talk, I will speak mainly about the first item of this list, and it will be mainly qualitative because things still very strongly depend on input parameters, but some most general things, to my opinion, are understood. But I will also quote some numbers. So, analysis of evolution of whole ensemble of binaries is population synthesis, which in my understanding is a convolution of evolutionary scenarios for binaries with statistical data on star formation history, binary occurrence of binaries, distribution of binaries over different initial parameters. And in this context, evolutionary scenario is a sequence of transformations which given binary can experience in Hubble time. And this term was introduced more than 30 years ago by Ed van den Heuvel. But let me start with this rather simple plot, which shows mass radius relation for zero age main sequence stars and maximum radius of stars which they can attain in the course of their evolution. And close binary in the theory is considered, a binary is considered as a close if the primary component of it overflows the Roche slope at certain moment of its evolution. This means that Roche slope has to be lower than maximum radius. There are several other important borders in this plot. First of all, there is a border between stars which produce white dwarfs of different kinds and neutron stars or later black holes. And I put it at 10 solar mass, but it may be, well, 8, maybe 11. This is not question not settled yet. It depends on who and how computes, because calculations through late stages of stellar evolution are rather complicated. And also there is a line which divides progenitors of helium white dwarfs, carbon oxygen white dwarfs, and here is a narrow and not well defined strip of progenitors of onion white dwarfs, which were also mentioned several times. If we assume, well, make it more or less standard assumptions that initial binaries have a flat distribution of log A, it appears that 40 About 40% of all binaries are in closed systems, and white binaries comprise 60% of whole initial ensemble. And
this is
based on observations, yes. And among closed binaries, as well, from initial mass function, it follows that low and intermediate mass binaries, this means between 1 and 10 approximately, as I defined it, 90% belong to lower or intermediate. So, what are the ingredients of the scenarios which are provided by stellar evolution theory and based virtually on thousands of evolutionary tracks which were computed by people during the last 40 years? What we need, these are the basic ingredients, I would say. First is the time scale of different evolutionary stages, the rates of mass loss in different evolutionary stages, the rates of mass exchange up on Roche lobe overflow for stars in different evolutionary stages and for different donor-accretor combinations. Then the nature of the products of mass exchange or mass loss stages. Mainly we are interested in what is produced, helium stars or white dwarfs or white dwarfs. And of course initial final mass relations. Then very important ingredient is the response of stars to accretion. This means whether do they swell, for example, if they are ordinary stars and form a common envelope, or if in the case of compact objects, we are interested in the outcome of accretion. Do the star explode? Do the star erode? Do they accumulate the mass? Of course, white dwarfs, I tell. Well, neutron stars also explode sometimes. Well, burster. Sorry? Black holes too. And very important point is here is the formation of separations of components under different assumptions of mass and momentum loss. Mass and momentum, and here is the input from statistics, which is binarity rate, star formation rate, initial mass function, mass ratio distribution, distribution over semi-major axis of orbit, distribution over eccentricities, which is put sometimes in, sometimes no, and normalization of all these things. And the most crucial momentum in all this stuff is, of course, mass and momentum loss from the systems. It was immediately realized by people who made the first computations of binary star evolution and tried to compare it with observations that mass and angular momentum is lost from the system. But despite 40 years of efforts, we still do not understand how the simplest binaries, like Elgal binary, which consists of subgiant donor and main sequence more massive components, are formed, because we are not able to get the distribution over P and Q. We don't have this from the, say, first principles and have to parameterize mass and momentum loss from the system. And here is simply a small movie based on, as I understand, Blondin's calculations, which shows that some mass is going out of the system, but we still don't have any firm numerical results for this. Well, this was in the movie which I stole from internet. It's responsibility of the authors. Okay. And
what is the basic obstacle in calculating this?
Well, it's three-dimensional gas dynamics, which is difficult. And people simply say that, okay, we lose everything which goes out of the borders of our computational grid. And sometimes it's a viscosity, all these problems which are involved in usual gas dynamics. And of course, we have to consider what is very important is different things of momentum, which are also associated with usual stellar wind, with gravitational wave radiation, with magnetically coupled stellar wind. And lately, people introduced in the picture the circumbinary disks. which we know. But the most mysterious stage of all this picture is common envelope. And the main reasons for arisal of common envelope, this is the stars, both stars get involved, engulfed in the same envelope, is maybe tidal instability for the stars with large mass ratio of components, or inability of accretor to swallow all mass which falls onto it. So this means that as the estimate of mass transfer timescale is very important. And the case of super-Eddington accretion rate is actually a particular case of the previous item. So, as I told, mass exchange transfer timescale is very important, and it depends primarily, there are many factors, but the primary factor is the mass ratio of components and the structure of the donor. And mass exchange is unstable, typically, if the donor has a deep convective envelope, say extending down to the half of stellar radius, or mass ratio of components is larger, or accretion rate is, well, and as I said, another reason is inability of accretor to swallow all matter. And as a result, a particular binary may experience 1 to 4 common envelope episodes in its life. And we still, again, despite several 10 decades of efforts, we still do not know how to describe the common envelope, and this also is a very familiar equation, also shown several times, which was introduced by Ron Webbing and slightly modified later by de Kool to formalize the evolution of common envelopes, and it simply compares the binding energy of the envelope of the donor, which is lost, with energy release during the spiral in. And it depends on this parameter of ignorance, which is common envelope efficiency, and on the structural constant, which describes actually how the envelope is bound to the binary. And in the ratio of final to initial mass separation, these two parameters cannot be disentangled. And up to very late, most calculations were done simply combining this parameter into one, say, into unity or 0.5, depending on the taste. And there is still ongoing debate about the role of internal thermodynamic energy in the expulsion of envelope. I will not stop on this. So, I don't know whether you can see, but this simply is a table from computation of Tauris and Davy, which shows how uncertain, well, this lambda parameter, structure parameter is. It depends on definition of the nucleus or remnant of the donor star and on the evolutionary stage of the star at the moment of Roche-Lobe overflow, so, and on inclusion of thermodynamic energy, and it may vary by a factor of several, and the problem becomes especially severe for more massive stars. And it, of course, still uncertain whether there are certain sources that can contribute to the efficiency of common envelope expulsion. Maybe it's higher than one, but it is clearly that it is not a universal constant as it is assumed in most of existing calculations. Okay, and simply to give you a feeling what means the common envelope, I plotted here simply the ratio of final to initial separations for a binary with initial mass ratio of Q equal 5, and for two different values of common envelope or this combined parameter, 1 and 0.5, and you see that in common envelope the separation can get less by factor 20, even 30, but this is what we need for getting a cataclysmic binary, and this was actually the reason why the notion of common envelopes was introduced into the theory.
This is based just on the equations you showed us before?
Yes, it's simply the same equation which I wrote. Mm-hmm. Yes, but there are cases when this formal is clearly breaks. This is, well, result, I hope you can see, this is this combined parameters, and here simply evaluated values of alpha lambda which are obtained in attempts to reconstruct back evolution of some well-known close binary white dwarfs. And you see that formally we need sometimes negative values. So
eta
alpha, yes, well, when you steal a creation from me. Yes. Yes, yes, it's the same, sorry.
If that's negative, doesn't that mean the common envelope thing's just wrong?
Well, probably it's... The formalist cannot be applied, let's say. Formalist cannot be applied. Yes. Something is lost by the moment from the system, but it cannot be described by this formalism. A palliative is introduction of angular momentum balance, simply to say how much, what fraction of initial angular momentum is taken out from the system. Then we introduce simply another parameter which seems to be more or less universal, but it is only a palliative. So now I will go to show you the evolutionary scenarios, and actually to the main topic of my talk. But I would like to say that to get robust results, you need to have a population synthesis for at least about a million of initial binaries. Then results become more or less robust. And if you use this amount of binaries, then you get up to about 600 different scenarios. This means different evolutionary paths which stars may experience depending on their initial mass, combination of masses, and separation. Of course, I will not show you all 600 because it will take rest of my life, but I will show you a greatly simplified plot which also can take the rest of my life. So it simply shows what may happen to a closed binary in Hubble time. And it is not so complicated as it seems. It's micro-eco, let's say. So we start with detached lower intermediate mass binary on the main sequence, the most closest one. So the least massive ones and most closest ones may be brought into contact by angular momentum loss by magnetic stellar winds, and probably they form W Ursae Majoris binaries and became giants. And as I told before, it was in the bottom of my previous slide, about 19% of initial binaries experience unstable first episode of mass exchange. This means that if the primary fills the Roche lobe, the mass transfer is unstable, a kind of common envelope or some dynamical event happens, and the components merge. And this is with formation of rapidly spinning giant, and we observe such objects, which later evolves into a white dwarf. And this is a fate of, say, 20% initial binaries. Peculiarly, some of the merger products are massive enough to accumulate mass larger than 10 solar mass, and maybe they explode even as supernovae type 2, despite that precursors were low mass stars. But majority of stars overflow. In majority of stars, primaries below overflow Roche lobe after main sequence when they have already degenerate or non-degenerate helium core, or already a carbon-oxygen degenerate core. The outcome of evolution, of course, can be again a merger with further formation of white dwarf. If there is enough orbital energy released to dispel the common envelope and not merge, then we get a pair of composed by white dwarf with a low mass or relatively low mass main sequence component, which does not have time or is not is separated too much to make contact in the remainder of its life, say if the companion is less than 0.8 solar mass. And this is the fate of about one-third of primordial binaries. Most interesting cases of evolution are, for example, if this star, the donor star, was initially more massive than about 2.5 solar mass, then and had and overflowed its Roche lobe before helium ignition in the core. Then the product of the evolution is helium, the outcome of the evolution is formation of a pair consisting of a helium star, the core of the donor, and main sequence star. And such systems are also observed as subdwarf B stars accompanied by main sequence star.
Is that helium core degenerate?
It may be, well, in this case it's not degenerate. But when the star burns its helium, it forms a white dwarf, carbon oxygen white dwarf, and we get a white dwarf plus main sequence pair. And, well, we know a lot of such systems, actually. If at the moment of Roche lobe overflow, the primary had already a degenerate core, then this pair of white dwarf and main sequence star may be formed directly. This is path 11. Then again, the further evolution depends on the masses of components and how widely they are separated. And if, say, the mass of the component or mass of the companion of the white dwarf is about, say, one solar mass or less, and separation is of the order of 10 solar radii, then magnetically coupled stellar wind and maybe gravitational wave radiation can bring such a system into a contact, and this is the way to form cataclysmic binary. But this, you see, is a very minor percentage, fraction of all initial binaries. And as we heard from Jean-Pierre, the outcome of evolution of cataclysmic binaries is quite uncertain. It may finish as a white dwarf, maybe with low mass companion, which I simply did not plot here. Or white dwarf may accumulate enough mass to explode as supernova, and this is the so-called supernova thing degenerate scenario for formation of precursors of supernovae 1a. Or if we have oxygen neon white dwarf, then it may collapse, maybe, with formation of neutral star. Then, if the star is...
It would collapse to a neutron star without an explosion?
Well, it may be explosion. We still don't know for certain what are the observational manifestations of such explosion. Maybe there will...
Weak explosion,
yes, something will be. And there is some... I don't have time to go.
Supernova.
It's not a supernova explosion.
Collapse to a neutron star via weak explosion.
Well, energy is released. It's core collapse. It is core collapse that the electron captures.
A tiny fraction is still enough to produce a supernova.
It's with supernova.
You have an envelope on the outside.
It's yes. Because it's almost a naked star. It's almost a naked star. It's.
They have enough trouble making yellows.
Yeah, but
it's not much easier.
It's too similar. Too similar to be, looks too different.
But there's no envelope.
There's no envelope. There's no hydrogen envelope.
The light is coming from radioactive decay.
Exactly.
Then you have to, but you have to thermalize the gammas. If there's not enough mass around, thermalize the gammas.
The positrons?
Maybe. Where do the positrons come from? Decay. But they say, okay, you might get some light from there, but they can...
That's still bright.
Oh, yeah, no, but still you have to get it to optical photons.
Maybe it's a gamma.
Yeah, something like that, sure.
There may be sources of gamma rays.
The gamma ray bursts could be something
Of Well, we don't know.
Piece of this diagram to explore here.
yes. This, you see, this couple of percent, fraction of percent, which keeps us busy, actually. Well, then, the main sequence companion to white dwarfs, the white dwarf evolves and forms the second common envelope in the system. Now again, we can have very different outcomes, and what is interesting for us is the case when you have the core of this guy is non-degenerate, then we have a white dwarf plus subdwarf helium star, and if the stars are close enough, they may be brought into contact still in the lifetime of helium star, and those stars have a peculiarity that they have almost constant mass loss rate or mass exchange rate of several units of times 10 to minus 8, and this means that white dwarfs in them can accumulate helium, and this is the channel which produces us so-called edge-lit detonations. Now, if the components merge, we simply sink into a single white. If components do not merge, then we have a pair of two white dwarfs. And now everything depends on whether these white dwarfs can merge in Hubble time. I mean on gravitational wave radiation. Majority do not merge and disappear for us. But some can be brought into contact, and then we have double degenerate channel for formation of supernovae 1A, or they may merge with formation of helium star, which later evolves into white dwarf, or if combination of parameters is correct, let's say, we can get an interacting semi-degenerate white dwarf or AM Canon Vermicorum star, in which also supernova 1A by edge-lit detonation or maybe by Chandrasekhar mass is possible, or a collapse may occur. And
can I ask a question about the two scenarios that might lead to the edge-lit?
Yes, please.
The right and then the left. Helium star is a full-sized helium-burning non-degenerate star.
Yes.
So the prediction for the AM Canavan phase, if that kind of star is the donor, differs from that if the donor is semi or more degenerate, just another white dwarf, in the prediction of the luminosity of the system. Is that right?
Well, the rates of mass exchange are different in two cases because this system has almost constant mass exchange rate of 10 to minus 8, and in this system the mass exchange rate goes initially from very high 10 to minus 6 or almost Eddington 1 down to very fast, to down to 10 to minus 10, and well, it's variable. And actually, nobody explored, maybe Lars starts now to explore, how such stars react to this accretion rate.
Yeah, it just seems to me that the helium star, I mean, normally you think an AM camera, you're looking at the disk.
Yes.
Most of the light is coming from the disk.
Yes.
And you don't see the secondary if it's this thing down here at the bottom, if it's a degenerate. Even though it's large, it's probably also fairly cool. But in the helium star, you have to see it, don't you? It has to contribute to the...
Well, but this star, well... this star is rather short. It lasts 100 mega years. So we don't, at that moment, we don't know any real semi-detached subdwarf star.
Okay, well, this is in the literature back over the decades, it's sometimes been assumed that the observed AM Kempians are these things?
Yes, there are two channels. I did not mention this, but during the evolution of with mass loss under the influence of gravitational rays, waves, say the helium burning gradually dies, and this star is converted into a kind of what is called in the literature semi-degenerate star, not completely degenerate star. And this is also a way to make AM Canon-Venetiquorum stars. So there are two kinds of AM Canon-Venetiquorum stars. Ones which are made with genuine white dwarfs which are brought into the contact. And the second channel is this channel via helium stars. Sorry, I did not mention it, but it is a really important channel.
Can you tell the difference when you observe it?
Well, the periods are different. This is difficult.
Yeah, that's my question.
This is difficult. GP-COM maybe is... no, GP-COM is not that channel. Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Well,
so,
yes.
So if you can measure the mass of the donor, then you can differentiate the center mass.
Yes, there is, but, well, but this is very, very uncertain. And it's very difficult to tell at the moment what is progenitor of this given system.
But don't the parallaxes in the Nielemans paper, Roloff's Nielemans, that he's going to be here to talk about soon,
yep,
do the parallaxes distinguish? Because they give you the luminosities and the accretion rates.
Yes.
They prefer the top box.
They prefer this one. Yes, but you know, there is a kind of... Well, I can show later the tracks if I will have time. But usually in this channel you can't go to periods less than, say, 20 minutes, maybe 18 minutes. And in this channel you can go to the period of even 5 minutes, maybe sometimes 10 minutes. This means this may discriminate the origin of those stars. Okay, and the, what is well? Since I had some space on this slide, I inserted here only one type of white binaries which are interesting for us as possible precursors of supernovae 1A. These are symbiotic stars. These are white binaries which evolved like regular, white stars. This means that primary component of them becomes loses its envelope by stellar wind, becomes a white dwarf. Then it has a neighbor which also loses mass by stellar wind, which may be captured by companion and maybe produces us a supernova 1A. Yes?
So, from our side of the camp, can we take from adding up all your numbers that we expect 1% of low intermediate mass binaries to end up in something that could conceivably be a 1A on that diagram?
Yes. Yes.
Sorry.
Well, I estimated.
Are the large number of nuclear flashes either edge lit or
or a real 1F? Is it about 1.5?
Yes, it's very simple test. The ranges, taking initial mass function and the ranges of necessary mass ratios of components and separations, there is simple formulas which give you. This was the exercise made by this in this 20 years ago by Tutukov and Ibn in this famous paper.
Does that
Grimming and sorry.
Does that change significantly when you include the Y-binary case that you?
This is small fraction in our computations, but can find some ways to stabilize mass exchange in these binaries and get a higher proportion from this channel, but I am not so sure.
But doesn't it always depend on the stage that you showed before of the common envelope, where you showed that the formalism doesn't really work?
Well,
how do you overcome that in order to get these fractions?
Well, indeed, in some cases, it does not work, but we can introduce, say, another formalism, for example. And we know, we can restrict common envelope parameters, say, because we know that we have cataclysmic binaries, which have to be not wide enough, not too short, merge at the end.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. It was in the very first.
That's how the exercise.
So that 0.7 in there is input, it's not output. That 0.7 is
sorry. That would be fair.
It is predicted number for this particular simulation with given set of parameters or for initial primordial binaries. It's given cell with given common envelope constant, and then of course if you use a different common envelope formalism or different distributions over initial mass functions, then you will get different num. But
you have to tune the initial parameters to use that.
Yes, we have to tune initial parameters and common envelope constant. But simply we know more by order of magnitude, we know the space density of cataclysmic binaries, and this gives a kind of limit to the parameters involved in all this simple plot.
And Heulemann, you gave your talk last week. Scenario different from yours. Yeah. They all wrap.
Yes,
together.
Yes. I will show simply.
They won't change.
Well, I will not stop very much on the systems which have first stable Roche slope overflow. They differ from the previous graph only by the separation, actually, which we get after the completion of first stage mass exchange. But the endpoints are more or less similar, and there are also progenitors of supernova 1a, but the first set of scenarios contributes much more. So this is a also was shown many times. This is simply a summary of all channels. This is better.
You have to give me the color version. I'll just take it off.
Yes, people who took it from the paper had a color, had a black version, and I have my personal color version for myself. Well, this is, well, Ed showed it, and only it misses white binaries. Well, this is a kind of a table which summarizes also for a particular combinations the occurrence rate of supernovae 1a progenitors, potential progenitors in different candidate systems, and classifies them by counterparts, accretion modes, accreted matter, and by gives estimates for a population which is typically, say, giga year old or is old population, but let's say for a population which is giga year old or a population which is 10 giga years old. And in our calculations, the only channel, I give only orders of magnitude Here, because the exact numbers, of course, depend on all these 17 parameters which were mentioned yesterday, but the difference is the orders of magnitude between different channels. This is more or less, to my opinion, okay. And what shows this table, the most important, to my opinion, if you have a population, say, which was formed in a spike of star formation, which occurred 10 giga years ago, the only channel which can sustain, say, a decent rate of supernovae is double degenerate channel. And if you have a population with the same mass which formed gradually during, say, 10 giga years, then also there is only one population. There are two populations. There is common double degenerate merger and edgely detonations, which are produced by relatively massive stars. So, and now I would like to go into some details which were touched in the discussion of previous talk. One was about what we know about the real precursors of possible double precursors of supernovae in the double degenerate channel. And this is a kind of, well, model estimate made by us several years ago, and it simply shows how much supernova precursors or white dwarfs with total mass larger than Chandrasekhar we can get in a magnitude limited sample. It shows that we have to survey about 1,000 of binary of white dwarfs for binarity to find one good candidate. And such an attempt was made, and it was mentioned by Jim. It's either supernova progenitor survey or SPI, which surveyed for radial velocity variation about 1,000 bright white dwarfs. Sensitivity was 2 kilometers per second.
I thought ESSENCE was a bad acronym.
Sorry?
I thought ESSENCE was a bad acronym.
This is
strange. Well, you look for very tiny details in the core of H alpha line, which is explode.
I just meant the acronym.
Okay, this graph was produced by Ralph Napiewoczki about year ago. Maybe he comes for conference with new results, but what is most important, that really this SPI project found one candidate supernova 1A, which has, well, let's say sufficient, marginally good, let's say, which has sufficient mass and short enough period. But there are two another systems which also may be candidates for supernova 1A. The first is KPD with this telephone number, which is subdwarf binary with white dwarf companion. Subdwarf will turn into white dwarf in 200 million years, and period of this system, which is marked here by red bar, is short enough to be a supernova.
And so the thing I don't understand about this is that these white dwarf mergers are so dynamical that the accretion rates are very high.
Yes.
And so the ignition of the carbon is off center.
Yes.
And it has nothing to do with the Chandrasekhar mass. So
maybe.
Well, I mean Ken can correct me when I go wrong, but my memory is that at these accretion rates, everything ignites off center long before the accretion gets anywhere near our mass. And then, of course,
maybe
it would say that it doesn't become a type 1A supernova.
Okay, but as I understood from discussion which occurred during the week when you were absent, yes,
yeah.
the story may change.
There's one
it's
in the last 5 years.
Yes.
That's okay. We need some creativity.
Yes. Well, but I simply say that. Okay.
Is that the addition of the white dwarf in these double degenerates has nothing to do with the Shannons of Carmass?
Maybe it does, but maybe that it is.
So it would be great if we could ignite them at 1.2 and actually blow them up.
Not the but what I'm saying is that is what happens.
They do it night on center.
But then there's not enough energy on doing the one.
I think
so I'm saying is that if let me ask the question. If I take all those that are to the left of the dashed line, which will merge to Hubble's line,
yes.
What's the rate? Forget the Shannon's car mass. I'm saying if that's irrelevant, then what I really should care about is the rate of merger events. My argument is that rate is actually overproducing.
No.
You get ignition temperatures for carbon.
Yes.
But accretion it alone may not give you that. And then the density may be too low to ignite by nuclear reaction and so on. But whether or not this happened has to be seen. But I somehow doubt that low mass white dwarfs that have low density also would need enough energy even in the merger to ignite the fuel. But this can be tested. Our colleagues in Bremen have run lots of models now with SPH to merge all kinds
of... Okay, so very simple piece of physics, right?
We put that onto our grid-based combustion code and we will see.
But I'm saying the very naive piece of physics, which Ken did years ago, and I don't think it's changed, is that if I just adiabatically compress a white dwarf, which I will because the accretion rate is so high, it ignites off-center. And that's just adiabatic compression.
Yeah.
There's no uncertainty in that physics.
It's not a spherically symmetric normal white dwarf. It's a rapidly spinning one. It's near break up because it's been merging with Keplerian velocity and all that. And all these arguments may not hold. It may not be adiabatic decompressed. But be careful. These are one-dimensional arguments. And the merger is a very dynamic event with involving Keplerian velocities and may lead to disks and all kinds of strange things. We don't know.
It's
a very old simulation by Moscovich from the 80s, which showed exactly what you said.
Well, I understand that this is
center, but without explosion.
Yes.
Two different things. So.
I'm just saying we're
that calculation that ignites at the base of the accreted envelope.
Yep, that way.
The adiabatic compression, it ignites off center, but deep within, you know, still the
accreting. Yeah. So I simply say that this is still an open question.
Yeah, right.
I would like to keep all, but.
I guess I'd encourage the spy survey people to give the merger rate of everything.
Yeah, well,
the merger rate of
just I would say that if, as long as I remember in this calculation which produced us, say, right rate of superchandra mergers, the total rate of mergers of carbon-oxygen white dwarfs was only by 50% higher. So this means that we are still in the proper ballpark. So I would not like to lose this opportunity, but maybe hope. So I have to finish probably. So this was also shown several times. This is delay times for after star formation spike, which shows that double degenerates can't last and other degenerates have, other scenarios have low time. And this was also shown by Ed van den Heuvel. This is completely different population synthesis code, completely different assumptions, but you see that the result for double degenerates and for a single degenerate scenario is efficiently the same. The proportions are different between different scenarios, and the reason for this, maybe worth to mention, is actually the different treatment of accumulation of things in semi-detached binaries. I simply made a very simple exercise. I computed efficiency of accretion over one solar mass white dwarfs in as it is implemented, say, in my code, which gives for single degenerate scenario the rate of 1/10 of double degenerates, and with Hahn-Pozyarlovsky, who have comparable or larger rate for single degenerate scenario. And the difference is that we assume that, first of all, accreting white dwarfs are hot guys. This means they blow winds. Next, if even you have, say, weak explosions that still expands your envelope, you inevitably, or not inevitably, but in many cases, you can get an interaction with your companion, a kind of common envelope formed during explosion. And this also results into some loss of the matter. And third, we include the possibility of erosion after Prialnik and Kovets at mass loss rates, accretion rates. And then the rate of conversion of hydrogen into helium and helium into carbon oxygen are different. And this difference, also there's a difference in the effect of, estimate of the effect of helium flashes, because helium is accumulated by hydrogen burning. But this results in the factor of several in the rates predicted for single degenerate and double degenerate scenario. And, well, I lost my conclusions, but well, I can. I don't know why I cannot go to them. Maybe. Okay, so I'm sorry for being so ignorant. Okay, nevertheless, I will tell what was written there. No, this I skipped simply.
No. Close.
You are close. Okay, so I would like to finish that evolutionary links between many classes of closed binaries are at least qualitatively understood for the moment. But quantitative results are extremely dependent on the input parameters and especially on common envelope formalism, absence of models for common envelopes, but some parameters at least may be at least crudely constrained by observations of binaries, as was mentioned during the discussions. And the most important problems which still have to be solved are mass and angular momentum loss from closed binaries, evolution in common envelopes, the merger of stars, how it occurs, and what is the evolution of merger products, and for supernova scenario itself, is what is very important, it is response of accreting compact stars onto accretion. What happens in explosions? Are the guys eroded? Is it possible to accumulate mass? And so on, maybe many more. Thank you for your attention.
Some questions during the session, but I think we should have a discussion now. Ken, go ahead.
The formation of the common envelope is driven by rapid accretion from the red giant to the white dwarf or main sequence star. And have you considered wind from white dwarf or wind from main sequence, which prevents the rapid expansion of the white dwarf or main sequence to form common envelope?
Not
the wind
in this
is very
case.
Important to avoid the common envelope formation.
Well, this is really an ongoing discussion, as I understand, about possibilities of avoidance of common envelope. And one of the topics which is suggested is maybe this energy which is released during accretion itself may expel some matter from the system. There are several papers on this topic, and there are ongoing calculations at the moment for Elgol-type binaries in Brussels by Van Rensburger and De Graeff, this group. But it is still not put into population synthesis. This picture doesn't include this possibility.
But that's very important to the.
Yes, it's very important. It may change. It may change a lot of things. Yes.
Some degenerate rate is also very much affected.
Yes, maybe it's. You can put this as another 18th parameter in the picture.
When is it in response to the onset of mass transfer or independently of that?
Yeah, in onset, in early phase of, rapid phase of that.
Rapid phase, then we have a hot spot maybe, which releases a lot of energy, but we don't know the efficiency of conversion of energy.
But this is already, unless one, if all one is invoking is gravitational sources of energy.
Yes.
Then that's already embodied in that energy formalism.
No, it doesn't.
Well, but maybe there is nuclear burning, maybe there is a release of.
I'm sorry?
Maybe there. Well, to my notion, when we have this common envelope, you cannot treat it anymore as a simple star in which. It's completely different object, and we don't know all processes which are associated with interaction.
If I drop matter from here down to here in a exponential well, I can't get enough energy to eject all of that matter.
Right, so the short answer is that I think they tap nuclear energy and do stable burning to get the extra energy source. Correct. They have to violate energy conservation or invoke a new source of energy. Otherwise, it has to be correct. And what they invoke is stable burning, giving you an extra energy source, which is now orders of magnitude larger than what you had previously. Mm. Whether or not that's true is a different question. But that's what it's all.
Yes, well, that's the open question.
I'm just pointing out that there are two different periods where the common envelope is important. The first of them is informing the binary that gets you down to that channel. And interestingly enough, you can change, you know, in population synthesis, as you do and as other people do in these calculations, you can vary the common envelope parameter and explore a wide range of values. And at least what one and I found when we did that, is that that value of the common envelope, how efficient you were in that first stage, you know, in the first stage, didn't matter that much. Because it was really a question of which systems got to survive. So if you're very efficient at ejecting common envelope, you end up with a certain class of binaries, certain distance apart. If you're not very efficient, those go away. They become, you know, potential mergers, and some other moves in. And although the core masses are slightly different, it doesn't make all that much difference to the type 1A supernova rate. But what does matter is that the point that Ken was bringing up, which I don't think you actually have to start the common envelope, is the question of when the second phase begins and the, you know, set of slightly evolved star, more massive star, fills its Dirichlet low, what is the appropriate formulation for winds in the binary? And those were those 17 parameters I was mentioning last week. It's that really makes a huge difference in what the predicted rate is, whether virtually all of those systems can become type 1A supernovae or virtually none of them. And so that's a huge difference. And so it's really the binary evolution more than the common envelope that influences what the result is. At least that's what we found when we went through this exercise some time ago.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that there's a clear message from Brian's talk and from Lev's talk that saying that you are bad, times are not good.
I don't agree, of course. No.
Okay.
Why do you mean this? Not
the message. I'm not saying it is true.
It's true.
To one observation, but one theoretical, with the same conclusion, which is interesting. Maybe it's not true, but it is interesting.
It's worthwhile exploring further.
Yeah. I think we should take a break for about 5 minutes or so. We'll reconvene. We have two talks after that, so be strong.
No!